It's not going to be a sermon all about childbirth. One of the things about funerals, at the opposite end of the scale from childbirth, is that you often find out things about the deceased that you wish you had known about when they were still alive, so that you could have talked to them about it. What exciting stories some of them had to tell. And one of our friends' mothers is a prime example of this. Gunvor was born and raised in rural Norway. She died in 2008, and we first heard this story at her funeral. The Nazis invaded Norway in 1940 when she was only 14. How could a young girl do anything against such an enemy? Yet a year later, when Gunvor was 15, she was actively supporting the resistance. She used to ski from one valley to another, with guns and ammunition stuffed down her trousers. This was a really risky thing to do. Had she been caught, the consequences would have been extremely serious. But her family took the gamble that because she was a child, the Germans wouldn't think she posed a risk to them, and they would leave her alone. And this proved to be a case. And I just think it's the most awesome story of bravery as she played her small part in overthrowing Hitler. Well, tonight's reading tells how two other women played their part in defeating another tyrant, Pharaoh. And the people of Israel had settled in Egypt when their own country was suffering from a severe famine. And they'd lived there for several generations, and they'd grown substantially in number. And there's actually no hint from the Bible narrative that the Israelites were anything but good and faithful citizens. However, when a new king came to power, he had forgotten how Egypt had benefited from Israel in the past. He saw their ever-increasing numbers and felt threatened. Exodus 1:9, "Look, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." It seems that the fear caused by mass migration existed even then. And Pharaoh's first tactic was to try and crush the Israelites through forced labor. Exodus 1:11, "So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh." But this didn't weaken the Israelites. If anything, it had the opposite effect. Exodus 1:12 to 13, "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly." What irony. The Egyptians feared the Israelites, yet they needed them. They provided the workforce for Egypt's massive building projects, laboring under difficult, dangerous, and dirty conditions. And they were also put to work making bricks, in much the same way as low-caste Dalits in India and bonded laborers in Pakistan work in the brick-making fields and in the stone quarries, enduring the grimmest of working conditions with little or no hope for escape. But still, the Israelites were not broken. So Pharaoh tried another tactic to reduce the perceived threat. And this story of the midwives is extraordinary on so many levels. First, I think it's incongruous that Pharaoh would even speak to the midwives in the first place. They were so low down in the pecking order. They were female. They were slaves. In the grand scheme of things, they were ordinary and powerless. So why didn't Pharaoh get one of his officials to do it for him? And I think this shows just how intimidated and paranoid Pharaoh felt about the Israelites, that he felt he needed to get involved personally. And next, the Pharaoh isn't named, but the midwives are. And I think that this is a subtle indication that it's the midwives who are the ones who hold the power, and Pharaoh, for all his wealth and position, does not. Exodus 1:15, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool. If it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, let her live. Another irony. Pharaoh was determined to wipe out the male line, but his real enemies were the women. Not only do the midwives outwit him in chapter 1, in chapter 2, Moses' mother, sister, and even Pharaoh's daughter will outwit him when they save the baby Moses, who ends up being educated in Pharaoh's court. But that's another story. Let's get back to the midwives, Shipra and Puah. Exodus 1:17, the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do. They let the boys live. Fearing God means recognizing that God is the highest authority, the greatest power, first over all. It means standing in awe of God, honoring God, and obeying him. And that's what these women did. They knew that God's authority superseded Pharaoh's. Despite the possible consequences, they disobeyed Pharaoh and let the boys live. Their vocation was, after all, to preserve and to protect life. Pharaoh had chosen the wrong people to do his dirty work for him. After my graduation, I joined the diplomatic service. This involved taking a series of tests and undergoing some rather rigorous interviews. And it quickly became apparent that they knew rather a lot about me. And the men in black had clearly been up to St. Andrews, to my university, to get as much information about me as they could. Nowadays, they would simply go on my Facebook page and read my text messages and emails. They knew about my faith and that I was an active member of the Christian Union. And one of the questions I was asked was this: supposing we asked you to do something that contradicted the Ten Commandments, would you obey us or God? Goodness, I'd prepared all sorts of answers to all sorts of possible questions, but I genuinely hadn't been expecting that particular question. And all I could think of to say that was my understanding was that many of the laws of our land are based upon Christian principles, so that it was most unlikely in the work that I was would be doing that I would be asked to break the law, whether God's law or ours, and that hopefully my integrity as a Christian would make me a more attractive candidate than not. I have no idea if that was what they were expecting. I think the image that came through my mind was a sort of James Bond film and my being given a gun and told, okay, Agent 00-1092, we want you to go and eliminate this person in the Baltic or whatever. Maybe they weren't interested in the answer. Maybe they just wanted to see how I tackled the question. And obviously what I said was okay because I got the job. But it did leave me wondering, how would I have reacted if they had asked me to do something that contradicted God's law? I never actually had to face that difficult choice. But it is a question for you. What do you do when you're at work, or when you're out with family, or whatever it is you might be doing? If something comes up that's questionable, do you stand for God, or do you go in the other direction? When Pharaoh heard the baby boys had survived, he called the women back to explain themselves. And again, I think this is extraordinary. Why didn't he send his officials to find the midwives and punish them? He could have had them killed for insubordination instead of asking for an explanation. And they, for their part, were not intimidated by his questioning. They came back with a very shrewd answer. Exodus 1:19. Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. And this was a really clever answer because it avoided casting blame on any particular individual, themselves included. And there was also a certain amount of truth in their words, enough to fool Pharaoh, whose knowledge of labor may well have been limited. The Hebrew women probably were stronger and fitter than many of the ladies in the Egyptian court, partly because of the heavy workload which Pharaoh himself had imposed upon them. This could easily have contributed to faster deliveries in some cases. And as for the midwives arriving late, that was probably also correct on some occasions. Their answer was truthful enough and vague enough to convince Pharaoh, and it also rang true with his conviction that the Hebrew people were too strong and too numerous for Egypt. So does this mean that it's okay to lie? I would say, in some circumstances, yes, if this is to achieve a higher, greater good. John Goldingay comments, "Where powerful people are oppressing powerless people, the powerless are not obliged to tell the truth to their oppressors. Revering authorities should be a way of revering God, but when the authorities are requiring murder, all bets are off." And in the midwives' case, many lives were saved as a result of their deception, and one life in particular was saved, that of Moses. Because the midwives stood up to Pharaoh and refused to commit infanticide, Moses was born safely. And Moses would grow up to lead his people out of Egypt into the promised land. And out of Israel would come the line of David. And out of the line of David would come Jesus. We know that because we have the benefit of hindsight. But the midwives didn't know that. They were just saving one baby at a time because they knew that that was the right thing to do. They didn't know God's purposes and plans and how their obedience would be part of a chain of events that would result not just in saving the Israelites and bringing them out of Egypt, but ultimately Jesus coming and giving his life to save the world. And I find that absolutely mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. It's a reminder that God uses very ordinary people to achieve amazing things, often by doing very ordinary things. If you think about it, the midwives were just carrying on doing their day job, doing what they always did, albeit in a potentially dangerous situation. But because they chose to obey God on their front line, because they chose to do and say the right thing, what an impact they had, far beyond their understanding, far beyond their imagination. And what was true for those midwives is also true for us. God can take the ordinary things that we do and use them to achieve amazing things, because this is what God does, whether we see the impact or not. However humble or unimportant we may consider our front line to be, God can and does use us there. When we step out in obedience, even in the smallest way, God partners with us. We do our tiny bit, and he can make something far greater out of it, which may have repercussions that spread far beyond our wildest dreams, rather like the spreading ripples in a pool of water. I remember my art teacher at school, Miss Johnson. She was a Christian, but not particularly overt about it. Maybe I just didn't notice because I wasn't interested in Christianity at that stage. One day, she did something very simple. She pinned a leaflet on the Duke of Edinburgh notice board. It was an advertisement for a work party on an island off the west coast of Scotland. Attending the work party would fulfill one of the required sections of the Gold Duke of Edinburgh Award. Ironically, I didn't need to do it. I had already finished my award. But the magic word Scotland had the desired effect. The work party was being run by Scripture Union. You can guess what happened. I went, and I became a Christian as a result. All Miss Johnson did was pin a label on a notice board. But I was brought into God's kingdom as a result. And how my life has changed. And the ripples still keep on spreading through the choices that I make, through the things that I say and do. Last year, I caught up with someone who used to worship here. She too has now got ordained. She told me that it was the result of something I said to her that encouraged her to go forward. I might never have known that if she hadn't returned and told me. And now she's spreading ripples of her own. And I think it's a reminder to us all not to despise the small things, the labels on notice boards kind of things. I think we often think we have to do really big, dramatic, flamboyant things for God, and that if we're not doing big, dramatic, flamboyant things for him, then somehow we're being insufficient. You know, we're not doing enough, or we're not doing what we should be doing. God may nudge us sometimes to do something that feels totally trivial, but God knows the potential of our tiny yes to create something that's so much bigger. We live in a world that favours the rich and the powerful, the brightest and the best. We can look around us, even here in church, and we can be discouraged. We can be tempted to despise the things that we do. They can seem small and insignificant to us. We may even be tempted to give up on faith altogether. But God works differently to the world. God favours those who are willing to depend on him. That's all he needs. He partners his strength with our weakness and does amazing things through us. And most of the time, we will never know what difference we've made. We just have to trust God that he will, and he does work through us, insignificant though we may feel. All we need do is lean on him. 1 Corinthians 1:26. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. So if you arrived tonight feeling small and insignificant, if you arrived tonight feeling ready to give up, be encouraged. You and God together make an unbeatable team. Remember that when you're standing on your front line, faced with difficult choices. God honored the midwives when they did the right thing, and he will honor us too. And we may not see the results of our choices during our lifetime, but God is faithful, and he will do amazing things with what we offer him. I'm absolutely certain of it. Amen.